I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
And good afternoon to you. Thank you for joining us on the program today. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about. First of all, it's Giving Tuesday, and I wanted to highlight some of the great opportunities. And we've been doing that somewhat consistently for the last little while. But today, I want to focus on our very own Quarters for Christmas. I also want to talk with the great people of Festival of Trees. And, of course, yesterday we talked with the Salvation Army, and we'll continue to do so, at least for the next couple of days, while I continue to keep the seat warm for Lee Lonsbury, who will be here next week. So we'll focus on Giving Tuesday. But, boy, big news today on every front. If you're looking at international news, you look at the summit that is going on over in London right now and some tenseness is in the air, particularly between two presidents, the President of the United States of America and the President of France. We're going to walk you through what's happening at the summit, what is hoped for the summit, and then also some of the little confrontations that have occurred. You might recall sometimes it has been with Angela Merkel. Sometimes it has been with the Prime Minister of Great Britain. This time the focus seems to be on the President of France. And you might recall that our president, Donald Trump, has always claimed to have just a wonderful relationship. They both came into office at roughly the same time, and President Macron and Donald Trump, at least at first, seemed to have a pretty good relationship. But is that faltering? We'll talk about that and a whole lot more. The other issue, too, is the special session of the Utah State Legislature. I keep hearing it will be December 12th. We'll see when we have the Senate President, Stuart Adams, on the line with us. We'll see if he'll absolutely confirm that date. And we'll also talk about what is likely to happen. What will be the format? What will happen up on Utah's Capitol Hill? And then also, education. At first, it was the sales tax. That was pretty much the big issue every time the tax reform was discussed. But now, more and more, people are asking about education. Is education going to be held harmless? We'll talk with one of the founders of Our Schools Now. You might recall that big effort that was underway ended up being a proposition on the ballot, but a somewhat interesting, dare we call it a compromise proposition, that all of a sudden included the funding, the additional funding for education, coming from fuel tax, and there was some real confusion on that. And thus, of the four propositions, that was the one that failed. But Bob will be able to chat with us and perhaps give his opinions on whether or not education will be held harmless, or maybe even the funding for education be improved. So we're looking forward to a great show, a lot of conversation. We'd love to hear from you on the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line. I always love to read your texts, and hopefully we try to do that on the air. And it's 57500, 57500. Now, yesterday, feigning a toothache, I was abandoned by Robin Garfield.
I wish more than anything I had feigned this toothache.
I know. This poor woman has been suffering, believe me.
I wish this was all a ruse to get out of work. I would stay here for 60 hours this week if it meant no toothache. Yeah, I need a root canal, but we're trying to push it off till January because all the insurance, you know.
I know.
Our whole life.
Isn't it amazing how much of our life is engineered by our insurance companies and the requirements thereof?
Well, in the Garfield house, we are very dental dependent. We have a lot of my kids, all of us, so we have maxed out everything. So I can hold on for three more weeks.
So poor old mom has to drag through the holiday season
with a sore tooth.
But I'm glad you're back again today.
I am back in some sort of fashion here, and I do have a few headlines for us, if that's okay to proceed here.
I don't think I have a choice.
No, you don't. I don't know why I asked.
I know.
Okay, number one here. This caught my eye. There's a huge increase in female hunters pulling permits in Wyoming.
Wow.
The number of women who are hunting is skyrocketing, and the number of men have decreased a little bit.
Huh.
Are you a hunter?
What? No, I have never. I love guns. I love target shooting. I love the collecting of guns. I see them not just as weapons of destruction or items of destruction. I see them as tools, and I also see them as works of art in many cases and collectible. Anybody who knows me knows I love to collect about everything. But I have never been the great hunter. Yeah.
No, my family hunts, and I've been invited a few times. I don't have any problems with it. I just never have gone out.
Yeah.
But it seems like women are coming into the sport more nowadays, and that men are dropping off a little bit.
I'll tell you, down in Eureka, first of all, we have a real hunting culture down there. And many of the really nice hunting grounds for deer and for elk and so on are in that vicinity. And I'll tell you, some of the women down there in the Tinnick Mining District, holy cow, you go into the home and the big trophy on the wall is not from that guy. It's from that gal.
Oh, wow.
Sitting over there. Yeah.
Yeah. I used to do a lot of target archery as when I was a teen. I used to go out in the backyard and just shoot a big styrofoam target, but I'd never have been out. Someday.
Yep. Okay. I want to know what they're hunting, though. Are they going after?
It says hunting and fishing licenses. It doesn't say what.
The best fisher person in our family, I'll tell you, she was amazing. And they had a cabin up on the Smith Moore House, and any time that anybody wanted to talk fishing, you talked fishing with her.
Oh,
she
yeah.
was the best fly fisherwoman I have ever seen.
Really? Yeah. Oh, amazing. I've never been fly fishing. All right, this is a sad one, but I thought it was worth mentioning. I vaguely remember this, but December 3rd, 1979, this is the 40th anniversary of The Who played a concert in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember this. There was a stampede.
Oh, I do
and 11
remember that.
People were killed.
It's
the 40th anniversary today.
That was up, if I recall, up at the front by the stage, mm-hmm. and people just literally got stampeded and crushed.
Yeah, I read about this morning.
Just, it was horrible.
Yeah, you remember that happening?
I do remember that.
Oh, yeah. What
was the date on that again?
December 3rd, 1979.
Yeah.
A stampede after confusion and lack of preparation for fans who had waited hours to make a run for first-come seats.
Wow.
You wouldn't do that now. They would know better now to say first come, first serve, front row seats for,
name
the big band of the day. No.
No way.
No, I went to that Kanye West thing over at Gateway.
Yeah.
And that was even a little terrifying because it was all general admission.
I'll tell you, it is really scary. I was, you won't believe this, but it was out at the old Bonneville Raceway, which was off 21st South, just before you get to Magna. And we had looked all over the place. I was at KRSP at the time. We did not own KRSP back then. And we had Alice Cooper, and we could not find a venue. Salt Palace, the old Terrace Ballroom, I mean, you name it, Lagoon, went on and on and on. We just could not find a place to host it. Even the Dirt Palace out at the, that was the old Coliseum at the fairgrounds. Even we were rejected by the Dirt Palace. And So we finally got the Speedway. And we set it up out there. It was kind of crash and burn. It was really fast. And, oh, man, we were ill-prepared, with restrooms and everything else. And there was one point where the sound tower was just scaffolding. And I thought that thing was going to,
Did Alice come out, though?
Well, We had the concert, but it was windy and it was dusty. I had contact lenses, and so I was dying. And I was emceeing the thing. And so I asked one of the promoters, I said, is there a place I could just, wash off my contact lenses? And he goes, yeah, right in that trailer. So I opened the door to the trailer, and there they all are sitting there.
No way.
There's Alice with the snake.
Uh-huh.
I went, excuse me here, I'm just going to fix my contact lenses. And they didn't say a word. They just
sat there.
Did
you just say, we are not worthy?
They just kind of sat there staring at me. But yeah, so. I really thought the sound tower was going to go over. I really did. And that would have hurt a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Well, watch the Fire Festival documentary on Netflix about that festival that went down in the Caribbean. That was terrible.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one's a little heavy. A Chicago mayor fires the city's top cop over ethical lapses. I don't know if you saw about this.
I saw that story,
Yeah, he was accused of telling lies, drinking in his police car. Mayor Lori Lightfoot has fired him.
Yeah, that, You know, if there's any position, and I've here in Salt Lake, I mean, we've had some controversial, you know, leadership, but it's usually because of a stand they take or something that they're trying to push that maybe the mayor doesn't like, or the mayor doesn't think that they're hard enough or soft enough on this particular issue. Fortunately, we haven't had a whole lot of things like that. But when you're, you know, I had a really good friend who was a chief, and there was a weird thing after an election, and he's still a friend of mine, and but, oh, my goodness, you know, sometimes the pressures of that job, but when you're the top cop, especially any cop, but especially the top cop, has to start at the top.
And especially in Chicago.
Oh,
and they need a good.
Chicago's so tough anyway. Yeah. Man, what a tough gig.
All right, those are all the headlines. I have one more quick question because it is 12:45, and I always ask a food question, and it is December.
Yes.
It's lunchtime. Mm-hmm. Doug, what is your favorite Christmas treat? Talking sugar stuff. So divinity,
okay,
caramel,
you ready for this?
Fudge.
People will go, ooh, yuck, fruitcake, really?
I like fruitcake.
My mother makes, and some of our listeners have heard me talk about this before, it's kind of a white fruitcake. It's not kind of that dark with the pectin and, you know, kind of things like that in it. It's more like almost, the only way I can really describe it is like a pound cake with fruit in mm-hmm. Fruit and nuts in it. And it is really good. It goes back to my great-grandmother Love. And so my great-grandmother, I never knew her. She died before I was born. But my grandmother made it. My mother makes it. And now I'm trying to twist Dee's arm. But I think it's going to be my daughter-in-law who inherits the mantle of the white fruitcake.
Ooh, I'll have to check out your recipe. We have a Miners is my maiden name, and we have a fruitcake recipe that my mom used to always make. It's a spice cake that she put the fruit in. Love fruitcake.
Yeah, I like this fruitcake. The traditional kind of dark, you know, fruitcake.
Are heavy.
I'm not the biggest fan of, but this one is really, really
good.
All
right, I'll put that on my list. Fruitcake.
Fruitcake.
I'll get
white
your recipe.
Fruitcake.
Okay.
Yes.
We're all done.
All right. Did I pass?
You passed.
We can continue on.
Great.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk with, we used to address him as Commissioner Phil Lyman, but now it's Representative Phil Lyman. He will be joining us, and we're going to talk about Avalanche Awareness Week. That's coming up next.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Right now, I'm watching an image of the President of the United States along with the First Lady walking through the doors of Number 10 Downing Street and meeting with other leaders for a reception there. I understand the Queen is hosting a dinner for those who are participating in the NATO summit celebrating the 70th anniversary of the Northern Atlantic Treaty Alliance. So we will continue to keep you right up to date. And of course, all of this is unfolding as the impeachment report is released from the U.S. House of Representatives. We'll be talking about all that and more a little later on. But when I heard about this, this hits a little close to home. Several years ago, I had one of my younger cousins who had been doing some snowshoeing and so on down in the Utah County canyons, and a friend of his was killed in an avalanche. And well, I'll tell you, that's where you have such mixed emotions because you're just shocked by the death. But yet, and this is human nature, we're so grateful, of course, for the life that was saved. And then you feel guilty almost about that because another family was grieving while we were just sighing relief. And, oh, my goodness, what a difficult, difficult thing. And when I saw that this is the first annual Utah Avalanche Awareness Week, I thought we need to talk with those who are behind this, and primarily Representative Phil Lyman and Senator Kirk Cullimore. They sponsored HB 380, designated this first week of December as Avalanche Awareness Week, and we have Representative Phil Lyman on the line with us. Phil, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. I'm glad to be on the show.
You know, we've talked about a lot of things over the years, Phil, and I've introduced you as commissioner and now representative. And I have to ask, what was the motivation? What got you fired up on this issue?
Well, you know, last January, we lost Scott Pearson here in San Juan County, a real friend to a lot of people here, and four little kids that were left behind, and a widow, of course. And about the same time, Anson Layton that was killed up in Idaho, Tommy Hawkins, and he left three little kids. And so, as you were saying, you know, your heart breaks for these people, and you don't know what you can do to help. And someone here in San Juan County suggested, exactly our economic development director said, hey, maybe we should do something to honor these families. And so we came up with this Avalanche Awareness Week, both, you know, to pay tribute to those people that were really hurting and maybe to help educate and save some lives down the road.
Boy, no kidding. The education is so important, the awareness, the collaborative efforts that can be marshaled to help in this regard. And then also, as you mentioned, Phil, to honor the Utahns who lost their lives either in an avalanche or trying to prevent avalanches. And it's not just about skiing. It's not just about skiing out of bounds. It's not just about maybe some cross-country skiing. It's snowmobilers. It's snowshoers. It's those who are out there trying to prevent avalanches as well that sometimes pay an incredible price for their efforts.
Yeah. Snow is unpredictable. And people think down here in San Juan County we don't have any of it, but we do have a lot of snow. We're at a high elevation. And so when I came up with this, the first person I thought about was Senator Colmore, because he's right there with the ski resorts in his Senate district. And of course, he was anxious to get on board. And then when the Utah Avalanche Center found out what we were doing, they jumped on with, you know, just amazing people and resources. And so a lot of bills that I bring up, I kind of am drawn a little bit more to the controversy. This was no controversy, 100% support. The governor liked it. Everybody, you know, was unanimous support, House and Senate. And so that's always a nice thing to come up with something that universally people recognize is, hey, this is important, especially for Utah. You know, we're just, it's such a hallmark of Utah is our snow, and we want to keep people safe.
Yeah, we're literally world famous for what we offer when it comes to winter sports, and probably the highlight of all of that, the Winter Olympics back in 2002, and it really showed off what Utah has to offer. But with every effort, every human recreational event or just simple transportation getting back and forth to various places, there are risks. And when you're in the backcountry, when you're out skiing, when you're enjoying the beautiful Utah snow, there's a danger that goes with that. I was looking over the organizations that were represented earlier today at the Utah State Capitol as this was kicked off, the first Utah Avalanche Awareness Week. And boy, every organization, state parks, OHV program, the Avalanche Center, Office of Outdoor Recreation, Department of Transportation, Ski Utah, and so many others were all involved. Sometimes it is nice to do something that will really make a difference and everybody gets behind and supports.
Yeah, it doesn't cost any money. It just raises awareness and people engage in it. It naturally want to be a part of it, and so it's exciting. It was fun to be part of this, and I was glad to be the bill sponsor on it.
We have just a second before we hit the top of the hour, Phil, and we're going to be talking about this next in the 1 o'clock hour. We've got the Senate president. I'm really pleased that Senator Stuart Adams could join us. We're also going to talk with Bob Marquardt, one of the founders of Our Schools Now. We're talking about the special session. What are you anticipating in this special session of the legislature?
I think we've got a ways to go on this bill. I respect the people that are working so hard and want to get something passed, but the way it stands right now, it's got some things that are going to really hurt some industries and some businesses in Utah that I don't think we can afford to put that burden on them. It's going to be an interesting special session. It changes. The bill is changing every day, if not every hour, with different little things. And so it's going to be interesting to see where we're at on the 12th. and I hope that they can come up with something. I like the tax cuts. I like what they're talking about there, but some of the things on the sales tax and the education mandate are they're kind of non-starters for me and for a lot of other people. And I know the leadership is really working to address those mm-hmm. issues. So hopefully that'll be in place. We can pass something that makes sense and helps people.
Phil, I'm only leaving you with a couple of seconds for a difficult question, but you have such mm-hmm. deep roots in San Juan County. People who know me know how much time I spend in Juab County, and especially in one of the state's smallest school districts. Do you have concern about the funding of the schools down in your neck of the woods? I do for mine.
It's a challenge. It's a challenge now, and what this bill proposes to do is kind of shift that over to the property tax side. And for counties that have a large tax base, that's probably a boon. For counties like San Juan County or some of these rural counties that have a low tax base, it's going to just increase the challenge for them. And somehow that's got to be addressed. The legislature values education. No one's trying to shortchange education, but this bill could do a lot to hurt, especially the schools that need it the most, the weakest of the weak. So we don't want to do that.
Phil, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. And now, have you heard as a representative definitively the 12th? I keep hearing that date, but I haven't seen any big declaration. Is it going to be on the 12th?
It's on the schedule for the 12th. I don't think it's a secret.
Yeah.
So that's the plan right now, and it could change. It's with any interim session, it could be pushed back. Or
right.
They definitely want to get something done in 2019, so that some of the tax breaks can go into effect this year. And so hopefully, if they're going to get it done this year, they've got to do it really soon.
Phil, thank you for joining us today, and have a great holiday season.
You too. Thank you, Doug.
Representative Phil Lyman with us at KSL News Radio. As I mentioned, we're going to talk special session for the next half hour, so stay with us here at KSL News Radio.
Insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Just as we went into our news at the top of the hour here at KSL, Adam Schiff walked to a podium where you were seeing the flag of the House of Representatives of the United States and the Old Glory, the Stars and Stripes, and he is basically talking about the report that is going to the Judiciary Committee now. The report from the House Intelligence Committee, of which Mr. Schiff is the chair, and it makes the case for impeachment of the president, saying that the president engaged in this course of conduct for the benefit of his own presidential reelection, to harm the election process of a political rival, and to influence our nation's upcoming presidential election to his advantage. The report says in doing so, the president placed his own personal and political interests above the national interests of the United States, sought to undermine the integrity of the U.S. presidential election process, and endangered U.S. national security. And then it makes the case for obstruction in the what is described as unprecedented stonewalling. Indeed, it would be hard to imagine a stronger or more complete case of obstruction than that demonstrated by the president since the inquiry began. Now, the committee is expected to approve this tonight and then send it on to the House Judiciary Committee. This report is based largely on 17 witness interviews. 12 of them were held in public, and we will continue. Let's just listen to just a little bit of the tone of what the chairman is saying.
The law. The question now is, what does Congress do about this? One of the other very important elements of our report today, which goes beyond the president's misconduct with Ukraine, goes to the president's obstruction of the Congress, of a co-equal branch of government. And I wanted to underscore also the seriousness of this misconduct, because the president informed every department for which we sought records, the State Department, the Office of Management and Budget, which has the records about the withholding of the aid, the Defense Department, his own White House personnel, to refuse to turn over a single document in answer to congressional subpoenas. The president instructed witnesses not to appear. The president used his office and his bully pulpit to try to intimidate witnesses. If the Congress allows a president to so fully and blanketly obstruct the work of Congress, even involving an impeachment investigation into the president's own misconduct, then we are begging for more of the same.
Obviously, Adam Schiff is in the process of making the case for obstruction of justice, and it's interesting how often, whether it's in a traditional legal case or whether it's something this high profile, which fortunately doesn't happen very often, but often it's not the alleged misdeed or crime that is ultimately proved. It is the covering up. It is the obstruction of justice. And sometimes it is the lying under oath, the perjury factor. So we'll keep a close eye on this, and we'll continue to bring you the latest information. But right now, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee is talking about the report now that will be forwarded to the House Judiciary Committee. Here in the state of Utah, we're all anticipating a special session of the Utah State Legislature. We'll be talking with the Senate President in a few moments, and we'll get some of the absolutes about that, if there are absolutes on date and time and format and so on. But I really appreciate Bob Marquardt joining us right now, one of the founders of Our Schools Now. You might recall the organization that has worked very hard over the years to acquire or promote or facilitate, might be the better word, more funding going into our public education. And Bob, welcome back. It's always good to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
As you look at the rumblings at this point, none of us have a hard document. We've heard a lot of the discussions, the committee meetings, some of the things that legislators have been talking about that are priorities. We've seen speculation. We haven't actually seen the document. But based at least on what we do know at this point, recognizing how hard you and so many others have worked not to maintain the funding for education, but to increase the funding for education, do you have concerns about the special session and the tax reform?
Yeah, absolutely, we do. You know, Our Schools Now is a group of business leaders from across the state that got together several years ago to try and influence education funding in the state. You know, businesses are not clamoring for tax cuts. They're clamoring for better education and the ability to hire workers to keep their businesses growing. And so that's really been the priority of the business community. You know, there are so many needs because of the growth that we've had for education, air quality, transportation, our roads, that this is a time to be investing in our social needs and not looking for tax cuts that nobody is that concerned about. I mean, there's not too many people that wouldn't say, let's invest in education instead of have a tax cut. So it's frustrating. The governor, you know, has said since he took office that the solution for education is we're going to grow the economy, and with the growth we have in the economy, it was going to lead to more funding for education. And so we have grown the economy, and here we are talking about tax cuts and limiting education funding, which will, you know, the discussion is going to be impactful for decades to come. So it's a pivotal time that we definitely want to get involved in and try and influence where this is going.
You mentioned the business community and how hard they're working on this issue and alluded to some of the very, very heavy hitters. And you go to the very highest level. I mean, whether you're talking, you know, some of the most prominent business people, right down to mom-and-pop businesses that have been working so hard to increase the funding on education. Amongst those business leaders and amongst those who have worked so hard for Our Schools Now, many are former state legislators themselves, and not rank-and-file legislators, but Speaker of the House, Nolan Karras, President of the Senate. I think of Lane Beatty and many others who are anxiously involved. So we have an interesting mix of people in business here, but many of whom also have legislative experience. The one thing that I wanted to really chat with you about, and this was something we didn't hear last year. Last year, most of the focus was going to be on the sales tax and whether or not it was going to go into traditionally non-taxed services. Now we have all kinds of other things, the sales tax on food, which is being discussed, as you mentioned, the state income tax reduction, the increase that would come, I think, to the tune of $40-some-odd million increase in business taxes. But we also now have the idea of maybe changing the Constitution of the great state of Utah to do away with what has been the earmark for education since the 1930s that still steers all of our state income tax into K through 12 and some for higher education. How big a concern is that for you, Bob?
It's a very big concern. You know, Utah is unique among other states of having this constitutional guarantee for education. When the, as you mentioned, is the when the income tax was passed back in, or 90 years ago in 1930, the provision was it had to be spent on education, and that's served us so well for so long. So to now say that, you know, I mean, basically the income tax is growing faster than the sales tax or the gas tax, and so the legislature wants more flexibility to use that money for other things than education. And those other things need to be funded. So, I mean, I don't think any of us argue with the need for funding our needs, but it just shouldn't be taken out of education or the income tax. And removing this constitutional guarantee could be very destructive. You know, we haven't really seen the specifics of what the alternative is. And, you know, I just can't imagine, though. I mean, the legislature in doing this wants more flexibility, so it's not going to be a better guarantee. All of the discussion in the legislature is let's hold education harmless and make sure that they continue to get the funding they've got and cover inflation and the growth of new students. But we've been getting that for anyway for a long time. And what's happened is even though a lot of money, new money, has gone into education, it's all been eaten up by the growth of students from our own families or from out of state and inflation. And so the per pupil spending on an inflation-adjusted basis really hasn't changed much in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And so we remain the least funded state in the country while over half of the students at every grade level are not proficient in reading, math, or science. We're losing almost half of the teachers that come into the teaching profession within the first 5 years of their entering the profession. So it's just a time we've got to invest in money in education, or the growth that we've had in our economy is not going to continue in the future. And that's what the business community is worried about.
Bob, I really appreciate you joining us today. There is so much to talk about. We could talk for an hour on this. I will not be occupying this chair on radio when the special session occurs. But, boy, I'd like to extend an invitation for you to join us on our Sunday morning TV show to talk about this. This is so important that we get this right, and I would greatly appreciate your input, and maybe we could look forward to that conversation here in a week or two.
Okay, I appreciate the opportunity.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us, one of the founders of Our Schools Now, Bob Marquardt with us. And coming up next, the Utah Senate President, Stuart Adams. I really appreciate Senator Adams joining us, and we'll get the lowdown on the special session. That's coming up next.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, we'd love to hear from you on a myriad of topics today that we'll be getting into. And, of course, you can do so on the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 575-00. Some interesting conversations already. We talked with Bob Marquardt, one of the founders of Our Schools Now, and I'm delighted to have the Senate President here in the state of Utah joining us on the line, Senator Stuart Adams. Senator, always a pleasure to have you join us.
And a real pleasure to be with you, Doug.
Let's talk about the ins and outs of the special session. Is it going to happen? Is it a done deal that it's on the 12th?
You know, we are working that direction. The task force has worked so hard. They've been working on this since we gave up last session. I think they've had 8 town hall meetings around the state. They've had 8 meetings at the Capitol. I sure hope we have a special session. We've given this a lot of thought and put a lot of effort into it, and I think we're trying to be thoughtful, and we're hopefully looking for that date. But, you know, the bill has changed so many times, and
yeah.
We keep trying to, I think the task forces listen, and we keep being flexible.
I've talked with your fellow Senator Lyle Hilliard about this. We've talked with over in the House, Francis, about this as well in all of those meetings that you alluded to. And, boy, there has been a lot of sweat equity put into this. And it's interesting. I recall last year, President Adams, you'll recall this at the Envision Utah breakfast. It was the speaker kind of dumped this out a little bit, you know, that this was going to be a big, high priority. I remember his term kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You know, Natalie Gochner always uses the term, you know, while the sun is shining is a really good time to fix the roof. And that was the impression that I got from the speaker at that time. But it kind of caught me a little off guard, and I think it caught some other people off guard, that this was being moved to the front burner last time. But the most of the focus at that time seemed to be on the sales tax and whether or not it was going to go into services, and if so, which services. And boy, now it seems to be talking about maybe constitutional amendment on the earmark for education and other things. Has this kind of grown out of what its original bounds were intended to be?
Well, I think the two chairs, you mentioned Senator Hilliard and Representative Gibson, have done an excellent job. They've really put a lot of time into this. And right now we're experiencing one of the best economies we've ever had in the history of the state. I think it may be a 2.5% unemployment rate. That probably is a record. A lot of us can remember when our economy wasn't doing that well. And so we're trying to put together what we think is using the smartest minds possible to put in place the best tax policy possible to be able to maintain this great economy that we have in the state of Utah. And I think we've done a pretty good job in the past, and we're really, the chairs are working hard, I think, doing a good job to try to put the policies in place with a lot of flexibility. It may have grown, but that's part of the process. We listen and we react to public comment. And I think that speaks highly of the chairs and the task force and their flexibility.
It seems that so much of the focus lately in various efforts, including the proposition that was on the ballot a year ago that did not pass, I think it was because of some misinformation and also misunderstanding, in all fairness, to give more funding to education through a tax increase, and it ended up being a fuel tax, and a lot of people were kind of scratching their heads on it. But over now many years, there have been a lot of heavyweights, including former leaders, for example, someone who was in your position before, Lane Beatty, somebody who was in Speaker Wilson's position before, Speaker Nolan Karras, were all behind this, trying to get more money for education. And this year, honestly, President Adams, I think some people are scratching their heads going, wow, we do have this great economy. Most people think we're really kind of a tax-friendly state. Why would there be a tax decrease at this point? And why would there be a conversation about changing the Constitution and the earmark for education?
Education funding in the state legislature is always our top priority. Over the last 4 years, the education budget's about $4 billion. Over the last 4 years, we put a billion of that in place, so almost 25% of it we put in place. We're number five in the United States as percent of budget. That means there's only four states above us that spend more of the higher percentage of their budget than Utah does on education. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very high priority. What we're trying to do, though, is income tax is volatile. It goes up in good years and goes down very low in bad years. And in the late 2007, 8, 9 period of time, we had 1 year when income tax went down 10%, another year when it went down 9%. When that happens, we have to have a strong general fund to be able to backfill education, or we'd have to be giving teachers decreases in salary. We've never done that before. So we think we're one of the best managed states in the nation. And we have to have a balanced tax approach, and that's what we're trying to do here is balance it.
Do you anticipate, and totally unprompted, I was talking with Representative Phil Lyman a little bit earlier, primarily about Avalanche Awareness Week, but at the very end I just asked him about the session, and I asked him whether he had concerns for education down in San Juan County, and he said, oh, absolutely. And he said that he was particularly concerned that there might be a shift or an encouraged shift, realizing that the legislature does not really deal with some of the local issues on property tax. But his concern, and boy, I've heard this from a lot of people, is that, yeah, the funding would come, and I've heard the term locally, I've heard closer to the districts themselves, which I think means property tax. Are we incorrect in that concern?
Well, in the current bill, the current tax reform bill, there's no property tax element. There is, what I talked about, volatility in the income tax. Obviously, the property tax does not have volatility in it. The state collects very little property tax. We control some of it through the education process and the vote and board leeway, but all of the property tax that is collected goes to education. So that's part of the discussion, but in this current bill, property tax is not part of it right now.
Right. I think some people are just wondering if there is a substantial cut that is earmarked now for education, that if that goes down, then where is that money made up? And I think that's what a lot of people are waiting to see. And Senator Adams, I really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you for the conversation. And maybe just quickly, let's assume for a moment that the date will be, and hopefully it will be, on the 12th. What will the format be? What will the day look like on Capitol Hill?
Well, we'll have a full day that day as far as a meeting with our Senate caucus, and we've already pre-planned that, but that evening we'll just have a regular special session, and we'll take the time needed to be able to discuss, debate, and to be able to hopefully pass better tax reform or better tax policy than we currently have as a state. And that's always the goal, is to try to make it better.
Senator, we'll watch this very, very closely. Again, I really appreciate your time with us here at KSL, and perhaps we can look forward. I'm a temporary host here. Next week, my former producer and dear friend Lee Lonsbury will be taking the reins in midweek, so I won't have the chance to chat with you again here on this radio program, but hopefully we can invite you to our Sunday morning TV show. You've always been great to join us, and I look forward to a conversation on that show.
I'd love to be there with you and talk more detail about what may happen. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you so much. The president of the Utah State Senate, Stuart Adams, with us here at KSL News Radio. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we've got a lot more in store for you. We're going to talk with the president and CEO of the World Trade Center, Utah. And in light of what's happening in the summit over in London and some other things that are afoot, we'll get his take all here at KSL.
Insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
So good to have you along this afternoon. There's so much to talk about, and we really haven't even mentioned yet that Kamala Harris has ended her bid for president, and she simply said in good faith, "I can't tell you that I have a path forward." You know, I always applaud people who just don't hang in and hang in and hang in and keep taking the donations. I saw that in the 2012 election to the point where it was beginning to really upset me. I saw it in 2008. And I'm thinking of one person in particular, and it was Mike Huckabee. He hung in long, long, long in 2008 after there was no path to a win. And sometimes I wonder about that, how honorable that is to continue. And Mike used to tell the stories about the widow who sold her wedding ring because she wanted Preacher Huck to be able to move on and become president and so on. Well, there was zero chance that Mike Huckabee would be president at that time. But yet he was telling this story, and it made me angry. It really did. And sometimes I wonder, are they just greasing the wheels for their slot on Fox or CNN? Are they greasing the wheels for a book deal? I mean, why? And I have to admit, I'm not the biggest Kamala Harris fan, but I'm glad she made that decision. When you don't see a reasonable path forward, rather than continuing to take people's money and basically take oxygen out of the room, there will be plenty of space on the sideline to make your points as a former candidate. And I have to admit, even though I'm not a big fan, I appreciate what Kamala Harris did. The summit is underway, too, over in London. Right now there's a big gathering going on at number 10 Downing Street where world leaders from NATO are all gathering for a reception. And in light of what's unfolding, and especially with some of the tensions that are bubbling to the surface during whether it's the G7 or whether it's now the NATO conference or summit, celebrating the 70th anniversary, by the way, of the organization that I feel almost more than anything else has kept the world from plummeting into World War III. It's interesting that we see so much disorganization and so many tensions. So what effect is this having on the world? What effect is it having on business? And Miles Hansen joins us right now, the president and CEO of World Trade Center Utah. And Miles, thank you for taking our invitation. What's your take so far on the rumblings that are happening out of the NATO conference?
Well, first off, Doug, thank you for covering this story. It's an important one for our country, and it's important for Utah as well. I think it's something that can be overlooked. And so a chance to spend a few minutes to kind of break this down for people here in Utah, I think, is important. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity to be on the show. To your question, you know, I think it's important for people to take a step back. And you hit on it just a second ago. NATO is the longest and the most successful military alliance in the history of the world. And nothing that we're hearing now changes that fact. It was set up in the shadows of World War II to do a couple of things. One, to integrate Europe, to try to get the Germans and the French and others to stop fighting each other. And it has overwhelmingly been successful by that measure. It was also set up as a bulwark against continuing expansion by the Soviet Union. And, of course, we know that the results of that, that was an overwhelming success as well. But even more recently, as the nature of the threat has changed, the alliance has proved adept at changing as well. So take Afghanistan. 9/11, within 24 hours, NATO had, all of our partners, had stepped up and agreed to help respond on our behalf and with us against those that perpetrated 9/11 against us. We've had hundreds of thousands of NATO troops, non-Americans, fighting and dying alongside of us in Afghanistan. NATO has been a huge contributor to the counter or the defeat ISIS coalition in Syria. Remember, ISIS at one point controlled an area the size of Virginia, and they have been geographically wiped off the map. And we have played a very large role in that, but so has NATO. NATO today represents over a billion people, half of the world's economic might and half of the world's military might. And so I know that the news is negative, and we hear a lot of rumblings coming out of London today, but I think it's important to keep this context in perspective that NATO is alive and well and doing very important work. Can it be improved? Absolutely. Are the discussions right now about how to do that important? Yes, they are. But we need to be very careful not to become dismissive of NATO and all that it's accomplished over the past 70 years and how much that means to U.S. security.
Boy, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think I surprised some people in a conversation today with, here around the station when I did say this is the organization that has kept the world from plummeting into World War III. There have been times when we have been on the brink. There have been times when it has been very precarious. But more than the United Nations, I think the NATO alliance has been that bulwark that that you talked about. But undoubtedly, things do change. And where before, when we talked about economies and we talked about military, we were talking about the Soviet Union. Now, when we talk about an emerging economy that hopefully could be a really good thing, but sadly could also be a very tough thing for the NATO alliance, we're talking China. And so obviously things have to change. Miles, do we still have you there?
Hey, sorry, you cut out there for a second. You're absolutely right. I think if you look at today, China is a rising power. There's no question about that. They are a superpower and one that's on the ascendancy. And within the next 10 years or so, you know, almost unquestionably, they will have the largest economy in the world. And another 20, 25 years, they will most likely have the largest, most powerful military compared to any other single country. And, of course, that would mean becoming more powerful militarily than even the United States, which to me underscores the importance of NATO. And like I said before, right now NATO represents half of the world's military might. And so if we look at a rising China and we ask ourselves, how do we manage this rise in a way that protects and advances U.S. interests how do we make sure that we are able to maintain the dominance that we have all around the world, whether it's patrolling sea lanes or enforcing or maintaining this international order, which has created so much prosperity and peace, not only for the United States, but for the entire world. If we try to go it alone, if we do it ourselves, the trend lines show that we're going to come up short, that China's going to eclipse us both economically and militarily in the next, you know, quarter of a century. But if we strengthen NATO, if we strengthen these partnerships, if we expand our cooperation, then any single country like China, it's inconceivable to think of China being more powerful than NATO. But when we have our friends and we're united by values and interests like we are with our NATO partners, then as we look at the rise of China, we can have greater confidence. And we don't have to be as fearful. We can stand with our friends and we can take a look at what a rise in China means to our values and our interests. And then we can work with our partners to calibrate a strategy accordingly. But if this idea of leaving NATO or going it alone, I think dramatically undervalues the importance of the alliance, not only in the past, but as we look forward into the future.
I think that's one reason why not only here at home, but amongst our NATO allies, perhaps save only Turkey in this case, there was such concern and even outrage domestically and internationally within the NATO alliance when President Trump just decided, without consulting our NATO allies or the NATO organization, that we would just arbitrarily withdraw our troops, create a pathway for Turkey to accomplish a particular goal of theirs. Now, they are part of the NATO alliance, but one out of, 29 members? And there really was not just, and it wasn't just Democrats that were screaming bloody murder over that. It was Republicans and certainly amongst our allies. I can't see where that helped our situation generally in NATO or specifically in NATO.
Yeah, Doug, you hit on a really good point there, and that's the process matters, right? We're not necessarily talking about the broader policy objective that came out of drawing down our force in Syria. And I think that a lot of people on both sides of the aisle and on both sides of the Atlantic could argue both sides of the policy objective, but the process to unilaterally and without consultations, not only with your NATO allies, but even by a lot of reports in your own Defense Department, to make that decision very quickly led to a power vacuum and a lot of death and destruction amongst our friends, our Kurdish friends in Syria. And it just goes back to the point that, you know, we could have accomplished this objective if that was deemed to be the best policy path forward, but it could have been a different process, a process that did include consultations across the U.S. government and also with our NATO partners. And that could have minimized the costs and downsides of the policy decision.
Miles, could you stay with us for a second more? I hate to impose on your time, but if you could, there are a couple of more things I'd like to flesh out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we will come right back with the president and CEO of World Trade Center Utah, Miles Hansen, with us here at KSL News Radio.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
I appreciate Miles Hansen staying with us for another brief segment, president and CEO of World Trade Center Utah. I wanted to play a little soundbite here. President Trump seems to kind of make the rounds. At first, he had Theresa May, who at that time was the United Kingdom Prime Minister, and she was very upset. There were a lot of tensions. Then we had Chancellor Angela Merkel, with whom the president was having some rather interesting moments. And then it was the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. And now it seems to be President Macron of France. ABC had this little report. There were some criticisms going back and forth. Let's play this.
Asked about recent comments by French President Macron that NATO is becoming brain dead, he hit back hard.
You just can't go around making statements like that about NATO. It's very disrespectful.
In the past, President Trump has boasted of his warm relationship with Macron and has had his own harsh words towards NATO.
NATO is obsolete, it's old, it's fat, it's sloppy.
Trump administration is now threatening tariffs of up to 100% on $2.4 billion worth of French imports, including wine, cheese, and handbags.
I can't help but wonder, this type of going back and forth and the contradictions that we see. Our president, sometimes even among his supporters, his ardent supporters, has their heads spinning. I often wonder what this does to our allies that are so important for our economy in a business environment and are so important to our national security and arguably, well, it's not even arguable, the security of the world. What is your reaction to this type of thing? As I mentioned, he seems to be always, you know, ticking somebody off to the point where they don't even know what to say. Sometimes he literally leaves people speechless.
Yeah, you know, Doug, I think at this point in the Trump presidency, especially, you know, he was true to form of the campaign and throughout the presidency, what we're seeing is his style. And he's a combative guy. He likes the verbal boxing match that goes on with his peers, other world leaders, with other members of his administration, with people in Congress as well, and certainly with the press. And so, you know, Doug, before coming back to Utah last year, I worked at the Trump White House, and so I was in on, you know, 20-plus meetings or phone calls with the president, with foreign leaders. And this is just his style. Even one phone call, he could go from being very combative and, you know, throwing insults and hyperbole back and forth to then going back to being buddies again. And mm-hmm. So I think this is something that we've all grown accustomed to, even if it still is surprising because it's so atypical for a president. But in terms of your broader question on, you know, what does this do? I think that other world leaders are used to this. And I think that if you look at Macron and some of his statements and NATO being brain dead, in some ways that's mirroring the rhetorical style of President Trump. And they obviously have gone back and forth on several different issues, but have also cooperated on other issues as well. So I think that most people at this point don't put too much stock in the threats, the insults, the hyperbole, but rather look at policy decisions and things that we actually do.
It is interesting because sometimes his rhetoric, while it, you know, people are stunned and they're you know, sucking in a big, long, deep breath, sometimes this seems to pay off. Sometimes I wonder if it's going to pay off in the long term, but in the short term, it certainly does. His threat to pull out of the alliance if others didn't start really ponying up did have some effect. 18 months later, 9 European NATO members, including France and the UK, have rather dramatically increased the percentage of the GDP that they spend on defense. And although only 6 countries other than the United States are estimated to be basically within budget on that, the numbers are up. You have to hand it to him on that. But is it a short-term win versus a long-term gain?
You know, that's a great question, Doug. And I don't know if any of us have a crystal ball. I know for sure how things are going to play out. But it is absolutely true that the, you know, NATO members have a commitment to spend 2% of GDP on their military. And very few have in recent decades. And this was an issue that President George W. Bush raised repeatedly. It's an issue that President Obama raised at almost every NATO summit, really hit home the point that people had to spend more on defense. And yet during both those presidencies, our key partners were cutting defense, mm-hmm. Let alone increasing it to get to that 2% target. And then President Trump comes, and yes, he's combative. Yes, it's atypical. Yes, there are insults and hyperbole and everything else, and yet we see people starting to spend more. And so there are absolutely some benefits in some cases to the approach, and he's been able to get some results. And I think long-term, the key thing is, you know, there's rhetoric and then there's action. And as long as we don't take any action that would be significant in terms of reducing our commitment to NATO, it would force other countries to start to look for other options. Mm-hmm. Then I think it's something that will pass with a new president, whether that's in, you know, a year from now or 5 years from now. But if we start to take specific action that would undermine the alliance, that would shake confidence amongst our allies, that over the long term the United States is going to remain a strong and committed partner within NATO, that's where I think we'd enter into territory that would have longer-term impacts that would be adverse for our interests.
Miles, I really appreciate the conversation. I appreciate your insights. Thank you for sharing them here at KSL, and I look forward to chatting with you again soon. And that will most likely be on TV, because in a week or so, we're going to have my former producer and great friend Lee Lonsberry doing this radio program. So we'll look for you on TV, okay?
Fantastic. Thank you, Doug. I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. Miles Hansen, President and CEO of World Trade Center, Utah. Let's take a brief break. We'll come back. We'll highlight what is happening during the summit. And then we're going to focus on Giving Tuesday here at KSL News Radio.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
This morning before I came down to KSL, as a matter of fact, I showed up just a little bit late. We tried to get here, you know, around 10, 10:30, and I got here today around 11 o'clock, and it was because of a doctor's appointment that I had following the eye surgery that I had in the last year. And everything was great, thank you. But I was reading an interesting article. I have come to really appreciate John Meacham. I think that he is one of the best historians and biographers in our country today. I think he follows in the footsteps of other greats like Joseph Ellis. I think certainly when you look at David McCullough, and there are others out there as well for whom I have an enormous respect. Ambrose was a great historian. Sadly, we have lost him. He has passed on. But I think John Meacham, he wrote the biography on George Herbert Walker Bush. He made the keynote speech, by the way, at the Spike 150 celebration up at Promontory Summit. And he had an article. It was in Time magazine. And he also authored the book, and I hope if you haven't read it that you will. It's called The Soul of America. Very interesting. I think he has some amazing insights. But as I was reading this article, and it was all about the impeachment process and where we stand, and they used Meacham to kind of set up where we are and that kind of never fear, we have been in tough spots or confusing spots before. And then there was kind of the argument for impeachment, the argument against impeachment. What was interesting in both of those arguments, there was no question in either argument whether things had gone as they should. The only difference in the argument is basically what we're seeing now is, yes, what the president did was at best extremely unusual and pretty sketchy, and at worst an impeachable offense. So even in the defense of the president against the impeachment process and certainly the conviction, it still talked about how sketchy it was, basically, trying to use common language here. And then the other said, no, absolutely, this is in impeachable territory. But John Meacham didn't go there. And he talked a little bit. And I read one thing, and it just stood out to me. And he said, politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are rather than the molders of who we are. I think anybody who's ever studied leadership, whether it's on a business basis, education basis, political basis, you name it, the idea of being a great leader is not to be behind the people, following the people, mirroring the will of the people. The idea is to be in front of the people, to perhaps give them a vision that they haven't fully fleshed out or even considered at this point, to mold the country, the entity, the business, through its great people, into doing things that maybe they didn't even think were possible. And I recall the old statement, and I was thinking about this as I was reading Meacham's words, that we get the politicians we deserve. And that kind of gets into the mirror thing. Again, Meacham put it this way, politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are rather than the molders of who we are. You think of the great presidents in our country, whether it was Washington or whether it was Jefferson or even Adams, and you look at somebody like Abraham Lincoln, you look at Theodore Roosevelt, you look at FDR, you look at Ronald Reagan, they led us. They were in front of us. They were giving us a vision. They were giving us a goal. I think even John Kennedy falls into this category. He challenged us. He didn't tell us what we wanted to hear. He told us that if we wanted this country to be great, we shouldn't be asking what the country was going to do for us, but what we would do for the country. And far too often a politician is just falling all over him or herself, telling you what they're going to do for you, and they're going to make this better, and they're going to do this and this and this. John Kennedy said, no, this is going to be tough. And we hear that a lot from real leaders. They'll tell us the truth. They'll tell us it's going to be difficult, but we are up for it, and we're going to be a better nation because of it. Ronald Reagan was famous for that. Theodore Roosevelt was famous for that. The presidents that I have mentioned. By the way, did you see the poll where 53% of Republicans felt that Donald Trump was a better president than Abraham Lincoln? With all due respect to everybody, are you kidding me? Wow. So I'd like to ask that question of you, and I'd love to see your response either on our comment line that you can call anytime, 801-575-7668, and also you can leave us a text on the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500. And do we basically now have the leadership we deserve? And does Donald Trump mirror who you are? I'll just ask it straight up. Does President Donald J. Trump mirror who you are? I'd like to hear from you on that one. And do we basically have the leadership that we deserve? President George W. Bush, in writing about his father, and I wish I had it here in front of me so I could quote it exactly, but it's something to this effect: there go the people, and I must follow, for I am their leader. In other words, following from the rear, following based on general public opinion. Now, should politicians pay attention to public opinion? Of course. But their ultimate responsibility is to lead. Their responsibility isn't to be behind the people, just kind of testing the wind and seeing where they want to go. The idea of a great leader is to be in front of the people and molding the destiny of the country. And we're all responsible for that. We all have our leadership roles in whatever size or capacity it might be. All right, I'd love to hear from you on that. We're going to take a brief break here in a moment. Toward the end of the program, I'll walk through some of the highlights of the summit that is underway over in London right now. But I'm asking you straight up right now, and I'll share some of the responses. But are our politicians, and I'll ask straight up at the highest level, is Donald J. Trump mirroring who you are? Let's take a break. We'll come right back.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
By the way, we're getting some really interesting responses when I ask the question, does President Donald J. Trump mirror who you are? That comes from an article that I read a little earlier. John Meacham didn't put it that way. It just popped into my head. But he said that unfortunately, in this day and age, politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are rather than the molders of the nation and who we are. And by the way, I threw this out. I'd seen it somewhere, but I just looked it up. And which Republican president was better, Donald J. Trump or Abraham Lincoln? Well, ordinary Republicans in a 53% to 47% majority favored Trump over the Civil War hero, according to a survey conducted by The Economist magazine and polling site YouGov.com. I'll just let that float out in the ether where I believe it richly belongs. Today, you know, we have everything. We have Black Friday, we have Cyber Monday, and today is Giving Tuesday. And there are so many wonderful ways that we can give through our community. And we keep hearing this over and over that Utah and many of our communities in Utah are among the most giving if not the most giving and generous in the entire country. And Festival of Trees is coming up, and Raquel Hayes joins us, publicity chair for the festival. And Raquel, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Festival of Trees has been one of my favorite holiday events for, it seems like, my whole life, although it hasn't been that long. But I actually can remember going to the Armory up on Sunnyside. I remember when it was, yeah, I know. And I remember, you know, looking up when we were doing a broadcast at Festival of Trees years ago at the Salt Palace and seeing our neighbor and her brand new baby and my wife and our brand new baby come to the festival at the Salt Palace. And then, of course, now it's in such a wonderful location.
Yeah, well, it is amazing. And it's awesome now. It's down at the Mountain America Expo Center.
Right.
In Sandy, 9500 South State.
Well, tell us a little bit about festival and what it has become over these years.
Well, let me tell you, we have been around for 49 years, if you can imagine. 49 years. We're excited for next year to be our 50th anniversary. It's going to be amazing, big celebration. Festival of Trees is a charity fundraiser, and all of the proceeds are donated to needy children at Primary Children's Hospital. Last year, we raised over $2.8 million.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing.
The amazing part is that the whole community comes together to do this. So many volunteers, from the cute little crocheted ornaments in the gift shops to the elaborately decorated Christmas trees to playhouses, quilts, wreaths, the amazing fudge that we have in our sweet shop. I mean, the list goes on and on.
You didn't mention scones.
I'm sorry, what?
You didn't mention scones. The scones are incredible. The cinnamon rolls. You can hardly tell where I'm focused, right? You know, it's
what? I was getting there, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
They've already got the fryers going in the scones. And it's already starting to smell amazing down here.
Yeah, we have to talk about the most important things. You know, the entertainment, too, that we see, and running into friends and family and realizing that all of this effort, all of these amazing things that are happening, so directly,
you know,
benefiting the kids.
Yes. I feel like this whole hall becomes sacred. There are so many families and friends that come together, especially yesterday on Decorating Day. To see them come, they kind of set up camp, right? They bring their chairs and they bring food. There's Christmas music blasting. And it actually becomes a very therapeutic place because a lot of the trees that are here are dedicated to children that have been in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people here have this close connection with the hospital. I feel like we are so fortunate to have this hospital that serves our children regardless of their ability to pay.
It is incredible. It truly is. And it takes a village to make this happen. I think of the various things, everything from the telethon now combined with radiothon. I think of over the years, Pennies by the Inch and Festival of Trees. The effort that this community goes to funnel the money into the charity care at Primary Children's Hospital has always amazed me.
It is. It really is. We really come from an amazing community.
What are you anticipating this year? How can people get tickets, and what will the dates be? Okay. Let's give some of the ins and outs.
Yes. So our website is festivaloftreesutah.org. You can go on there to buy tickets. It is open to the public tomorrow, Wednesday, December 4th, through Saturday, December 7th. Our hours are 10 a.m. to 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Tickets are $4 for children, $7 for adults. Wednesday is family day, and that's $20 for an immediate family of six.
Well, that is great. That is a real value. Back to the website again. It's festivaloftreesutah.org.
Yes, spell out Utah, U-T-A-H.
Mm-hmm. And it runs again from when to when? Open to the public?
The 4th through the 7th.
The 4th through the
7th. 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Down here at Mountain America Expo.
Let's talk about some of the other things that will be going on stages, entertainment, things like that. How do you round all that up?
Well, let me tell you, we have, they contact us.
Yeah, I'll bet. Think,
you know, they just love to come down here and perform, and it's such a fun thing. We have two stages, and we have people performing out in the lobby. We have singers, dancers, choirs. We have aerialists. We have, oh my goodness, tap dancers. It is a party, and it's pure magic.
I remember back in the day, we'd go out to see my little, my cousin's son, Clog. Do you remember when that was all the rage?
Oh, yeah.
We'd be there watching at the festival, watching Brad Clog out there. So you never know what you'll see on the stage.
You never know. The funnest, I think, is when we close up shop on Saturday night. We have the Salt Lake Scots come, and they bring their bagpipes, and they walk, they kind of parade through the trees with all of the ladies on the board, and it is extra special.
It has always amazed me that you deliver these trees. How in the world do you do that, the bigger ones?
It is tricky, but
yeah.
It makes for a really special event. So all of the trees and everything that's under the tree is packaged up, and we set them up exactly like they're set up here, and whoever buys them, so in their home or business, we just set it up exactly like that.
It is remarkable.
And that makes it easy, right? If you just want a whole scene, it's done.
You know, it's amazing how many businesses will do that and how many families will do that. They'll just recognize that first and foremost, this is a wonderful donation to Primary Children's Hospital. And second, a little side benefit is they don't have to put the lights on. They don't have to decorate. This will be delivered to their home or business. It's a pretty good, as we say in Utah, a pretty good deal.
You know, it really is. They love it. And it's been so fun over the years. I think I've delivered trees for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, and every year. It is really special to go into those homes and see the joy that these trees bring.
Yep, absolutely. I can't thank you enough for joining us and for this great effort. And the Festival of Trees is just such an integral part of our holiday celebration here in the state of Utah. Thank you for all you do. And I look forward to seeing it this year.
Thank you. We sure appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Thank you. That is Raquel Hayes, Publicity Chair for Festival of Trees. And again, for more information, you can go to festivaloftreesutah.org. You know, there's something else, and I was just looking. James Yapias is out in the hall right now waiting to come in, director of the Salt Lake Education Foundation, and here at KSL for as long as I've been here, and even before, I know that's hard to believe, even before Quarters for Christmas has been a very important part of what we do at KSL and what happens here in the state of Utah throughout our listening area. So we'll talk about Quarters for Christmas and how on this day, this Tuesday of giving, Giving Tuesday, we'll talk about quarters coming up next. By the way, I wanted to quickly remind you that you can take us here at KSL wherever you go. You can listen live and on demand, download the KSL News Radio app, and it's powered by our friends at Any Hour Services.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
It is Giving Tuesday, and there's just something magic about our communities, and thankfully, this is somewhat universal. This is nothing exclusive to us here in the state of Utah. We human beings are giving individuals, especially if given the right motivation and the right understanding. And we've already talked about Festival of Trees, which for so many years now, they're going to be celebrating their 50th anniversary before too long. Can you believe that? It has benefited so many kids at Primary Children's Hospital. It's something that we have all loved in this community, first of all, for what it does for the kids, but second of all, what it does for all of us, bringing us together during this very special time of year. But another thing that I think has been a real common denominator for many of us, a real binding factor, and a very easy and a wonderful way to give, has been Quarters for Christmas here at KSL. And boy, ever since I was a kid in my teens, I was aware, thanks to Bob Simmons, who used to do the morning show here at KSL. I won't go through all the details, but
he motivated me as a very young kid to give to Quarters for Christmas. And I'm so pleased that James Yapias is here with us, director of the Salt Lake Education Foundation. James, it's always good to see you walk through the door. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about, first of all, where does the Quarters for Christmas money go? You know, we used to say it's for shoes for kids, mm-hmm. and it still is. But it's even more than that now.
Absolutely. First of all, I want to say on behalf of Youth Association Public School Foundations and the Salt Lake Education Foundation, we want to thank you for all the contributions that Quarters for Christmas has been able to provide for our families. We're excited for this opportunity and throughout for, you know, what's amazing is for the past 9 years, we've been, you know, Quarters for Christmas has donated $1.23 million to families for the past wow. 9 years. And it has impacted 41 school districts and 77 public charter schools. And we have really touched the lives of 20,000 families in the state.
And that's just
Utah.
In the 9 years.
Yes, exactly. And it's just amazing because it impacts their household. Many students come to school without a hat, coat, clubs. And when you see that, you know, our counselors and administrators and teachers, they, you know, obviously they see the need, and this certainly fills in the gap. And we appreciate all the support that's been given for the years that's taken place. And, you know, more and more we see students, you know, although our economy is doing great, but the need has wage gap has increased.
Right.
Also, household, when we look at the economy and also the, you know, families struggling to pay their rent, this certainly during the holidays has been a significant contribution to our families.
It's been interesting to watch this great cause evolve. And mm-hmm. morph a little bit over the years to accommodate the changing times, accommodate more and more people. And, you know, back in the day when it was still a relatively young event and, you know, made money, certainly, but boy, not to the degree it does today. Some of the ways that we distributed the money, I think it's so magic now to have this outlet, to have this way, to get it so directly. And I try to think who is in a better position to recognize a need, who is in a better position to see a child mm-hmm. and see perhaps some vulnerabilities or some areas where there could be help than our teachers and our counselors and those who work in our schools.
Absolutely. You know, every day we hear from our counselors and our teachers and, you know, as I've said before, the need's great. The students come to school. And sometimes you see them waiting for the bus, you know, without a coat or a hat.
Yeah.
And when they come to school, sometimes they're walking to school a mile or two, and you can tell the needs there. And so, you know, when we get a phone call and prior, you know, before December 20th, we're actually buying those hats and gloves and making sure that the families have that for the holidays. So it's an incredible opportunity for us to be able to do that. And we wouldn't be able to do that if it wasn't for the generous support of our community and obviously KSL Quarters for Christmas. This last year we received 198,000, 13,800 of that went straight to Salt Lake City School District Foundation to meet the needs of our families. And we will definitely be given 276 Walmart cards, $50 each. Yeah. To the family. So it's just a tremendous impact.
I've always loved that about Quarters for Christmas, the dignity of the program. I remember for years, you know, I said, if you just think we were buying leftover army boots or something, they're in a warehouse and we just kind of stick them on a kid's foot. That's not the way it works. There is a real dignity to this. There is the opportunity to go into stores where we all shop and buy what is needed.
Absolutely. You know, because we send the money to all the different districts, you know, what we've also asked them is to use the stores that are closer to their home, that they will be able to buy the gift cards to provide for the families. And that's helped also in Southern Utah. You know, you don't have the bigger stores there, but it certainly has been a nice option for them to be able to go to their local stores, and that's helped quite a bit. I think one thing that we've learned from all this is that as our student population, our student population increases, the need is greater. And I think we've seen more people come to Utah, and we're beginning to see a significant need. And so certainly this has been helpful. And throughout the year, we've seen more and more students come to our schools with a significant you know, situations that at home or school that they, you know, the need's great. So
over the 42 years that I've been here at KSL and have seen Quarters for Christmas work for our community, and as I mentioned, it goes back even before my time, so it's been around a long, long time. I've often said that I wish that each and every one of our listeners could see and participate as we get to do here at KSL, see the kids. Occasionally, I've actually delivered the big, gigantic checks, and it is remarkable, the tears and the happiness and the joy, especially at this time of year and throughout the year, for the need is really remarkable. When a teacher or a counselor or somebody, maybe you could tell everybody how this works, they spot this beautiful little child over here, but it's obvious. This kid needs some help. This kid, this family needs a coat and maybe a new pair of shoes or boots or whatever. How does it work?
Well, the process in what we have established is that so the teacher, counselor, family support person in school, they may you know, contact the Salt Lake Education Foundation or work through their administration, administrator in the school to be able to request those gift cards. And certainly immediately what we process that and get those gift cards to the administrators. The way in Salt Lake City School District we do it is we do it based on the percentage of students of free and reduced lunch that need it, the students that will not be able to get other gifts through other organizations. So we identify those families in need and make sure that those opportunities are there for them. So once we do that, then we get those gift cards to the families. As a matter of fact, in a couple of situations, we've even gone with the families to go to the store and shop with them because they need transportation. So we've been able to provide that for them. And actually, we'll be doing that in the next couple of days also. Yeah. It is great because the families, you know, some families will say, look, I just need it for hats and gloves and something for my – a toy for my daughter or my son. But then you get to the store, it's amazing how they have learned to shop with $50 and be able to do what they can. And so – through other generous donations, we help a little bit more, but this certainly gets them started. But they have our families are really very humble, and they love it. And one situation a couple of weeks ago, we had 11 members living in the home, and you can tell they're young, children in the home, and we were definitely there to support them. And the mom was very, very appreciative, and so we do those type of things. We identify the families, and we visit the homes. We contact the counselors, work with the administrators, and that's that process. That's, you know, that process that we use in Salt Lake City School District.
Wow. Yeah. Sometimes we there are different ways that the money flows in, of course. Sometimes at our collection boxes, we always have a collection box, of course, out in our main lobby. Some people mail it in to KSL Broadcast House, and It's interesting, although we don't get the mail like we used to. Things have just changed. But it always impressed me. We'd open an envelope or a card. Often it was in a card. And all the stories just touched me deeply. But there's one in particular that we get regularly, and that is I was a recipient or my family was a recipient of Quarters for Christmas. Thank you so much. Things are so much better now. And now it's our turn to give. And boy, that really, really touches me. What would you say to somebody who is thinking, you know, this sounds kind of cool. Maybe I ought to donate. What would you say to them?
Well, I can say, first of all, you know, we love the families, you know, and we want to make sure that, they know that the money is going straight to the families. And and certainly the generosity that many people have, it's a big payoff. You may not know that it is impacting their lives, but in the end, it is. You're touching many, many, many lives. And like I've said, 20,000 families in the state of Utah have been impacted. $1.2 million, over $1.2 million in contributions. And that has been directly given to the families. And right. that's, you know, you can't really ask for more. And all I can say is that if you're out there and you see the sign, the Quarters for Christmas sign, you know it's going right to the families. Yeah. And, you know, and you will see a smile from a student, you know, throughout the state. You're just impacting many, many, many lives.
And everything we just talked about, that was just in the last 9 years.
Exactly.
I mean, imagine how much good has been done over now the many decades of Quarters for Christmas. James, thank you. And I hope you'll take our best back to all of the people. Really, you guys are on the front lines, and you're the ones that make sure that these monetary assets, they get to the people that need them. And I can't tell you how much we appreciate the very crucial role you play. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for all the support.
It's also been fun over the years, and again, I've seen this in my career, where this has spread now through our KSL family. It's spread to our sister stations. It's spread to other Deseret management companies like Deseret Book and so on, and we appreciate all of their participation as well. This is the time to donate to Quarters for Christmas, and let's make it official. Our Quarters for Christmas time is $2.49.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, interesting to talk with two great individuals who distribute so much wonderful money to such great causes. James Yapias joining us just a moment ago, Quarters for Christmas money and how it's distributed. And earlier we talked with Raquel Hayes, publicity chair for Festival of Trees, and what a great event that is to help the kids at Primary Children's Hospital on this Giving Tuesday. Okay, there is a big mystery afoot here at KSL, and I'm going to have to ask you to jump on board here, Jeff Kaplan, because I am asking the question on the show today, does Donald Trump mirror you? Now, this comes from John Meacham's article in Time magazine. And he was just talking about the times that we are in. He wasn't really making a case for or against Donald
Trump.
I've
liked his writing for years and years.
I have, too. I have an enormous respect for him. And then there were the people in the article afterwards who made the case for impeachment and against impeachment. But in his part of the article, he said, politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are rather than molders. So I asked the question, and it was, does Donald J. Trump mirror who you are? And I got this one. I did not vote for Trump. He absolutely does not mirror who I am. However, I think he must mirror those who voted for him and continue to support him. Otherwise, they would be turned off and abandon him. And then it goes down to, in no way does Donald Trump mirror me. I pride myself on being kind and compassionate. Two words that would never describe him. But in between those two on your screen is something else.
Do I really have to read this?
You have to read it, yeah.
Okay.
It's your lot in life.
It says, it's a text to you. It says, Trump's ego is smaller than your, Doug, and he is honest about it.
Ooh. Must have a genuine hater out there.
Are you getting the vapors?
I'm getting the vapors here. I may not be able to carry on. You may have to take over the show 4.5 minutes early.
Not going to happen.
Lordy, Miss Scarlett, I don't know if I can take this. But anyway, we've also got this up on our Facebook page, and I'm just leaning over to hit that. And we're asking this question. Presidential biographer John Meacham has written that American politicians are more often mirrors of their constituents rather than molders. Doug Wright wants to know what you think. You ready for these numbers? Those who believe our politicians today are molders, in other words, true leaders, 18%. Those who believe our politicians simply mirror us. There's this great little image of a chihuahua walking in front of a mirror, and it looks in, sees itself, and jumps, 82%. Wow. Okay, I wanted to highlight some of the things that are going on right now. And over in London, we have a summit that is underway, and some interesting harsh words were spoken on this. Listen to this.
NATO is becoming different than it was, much bigger than it was, and much stronger than it was because people are now fulfilling their commitments here.
Well, you know, some of the harsh words apparently from our president have led to people who are participants in NATO to ponying up a little more money on that, which is kind of interesting. And you have to hand it to Donald Trump on that one. He really has generated some more income for NATO by threatening actually to pull out of NATO. There are some other interesting things that are being said over at the summit, and I'm just looking for the page that we've got here. Somewhere I misplaced the actual sound that I wanted to play in these dramatic final moments. Okay, here we go. The president talked about those who were a little short on their payments, and he had this to say.
They were short of it last year, the year before, the year before, the year before, right? So they're short all these years. Well, in theory, you don't just say, that's okay, you don't have to ever pay. I mean, they really owe all that money from the past.
And as I mentioned, his threat to pull out of NATO, which stunned everybody there last time around, had an effect. And a lot of the European NATO members, including France and the UK, have increased the percentage of their GDP. But it was the president of France who said it's not all about the money.
When we speak about NATO, it's not just about money. We have to be respectful with our soldiers. The first burden we share, the first cost we pay, is our soldiers' lives.
Yeah, he said the first thing to remember, it's not all about the money, it's protecting our soldiers. And then the president of France, President Macron, also acknowledged that the United States was indeed over-invested in NATO.
The U.S. over-invested decade after decade and is number one by far. And I do share the statement. That's why I'm a strong supporter of a stronger European component in NATO, which is exactly what we are doing.
It'll be interesting to see what comes of all of this, and we're going to continue to keep an eye on it for you here at KSL News Radio. Tomorrow things go before the House Judiciary Committee. That should be interesting. We'll be paying close attention to that as well. And let me just share a few more of the texts that have come in. This person, regarding the president mirroring them, this person said, not only is that a big no, it's a hell no. And better than Lincoln? Remember, 53% of Republicans in a poll said, no, Donald Trump is a better president than Abraham Lincoln. You can keep leaving your texts. We always enjoy reading them here at KSL News Radio.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now, too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.